Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration, collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview is with Mohamed Abougaff and Daniel Carcenti, and we talk about their brilliant and compelling and exciting, terrifying actually, new film in some respects called The Devil's Drivers. And again, I don't know that there's an interview that I have where I don't recommend my audience, my listeners, to actually try to see this film. And I know you can't see everything maybe that I see, but this is for those of you who are looking into a new perspective into politics and the politics of the Middle East, but also a singular to a universal story, The Devil's Drivers is for you. It's about two Bedouin cousins who are smuggling undocumented workers through the Middle East. I mean, this is a breathtaking portrait of human trafficking in one of the most dangerous regions and places in the world. And it's really well done. It plays like a thriller in some respects. This is about others. This is about the value and the pursuit of freedom. This is about the legitimacy of others and how we need to recognize that in so many different ways. The price that some of these people are paying for access to freedom. This is about how the emotional becomes political, and maybe on a more cynical side, that there really are no clear cut answers sometimes, and no real clear cut solutions to some of these universal problems. And it's a really a brilliant reminder of all that so many of us in the world take for granted. And this is a unique story. You're not going to see a film like it anywhere else. It's a film. It's a film about family as well. I mean, there are so many threads I think that run through my work here on Face to Face and the conversations that I have. And this is a film about family and about the human experience and how Mohamed and Daniel have humanized that struggle. So thanks to them and congrats to them on this beautiful film that played at Toronto International Film Festival. I hope you get to see it soon on video on demand or at a theater or a festival coming, in the not so distant future. Stay tuned for that. DavidPeckLive.com, FaceToFaceLive.ca, the same place on the net. You can get a copy of Real Change is Incremental. You can find out more about my speaking and my writing there, but you can also find access to almost 600 interviews I've done over the last 8 years with actors and producers and writers and directors and filmmakers who are telling stories, who are allowing us to empathize with others around the world in unique and interesting and compelling ways. Sign up for our newsletter. We only send out a couple a year. But more importantly, if you're listening, wherever you're listening, please sign up to the RSS feed. Sign up to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Spotify. And if you're watching or listening on YouTube, give us a thumbs up, subscribe to the channel. We'd appreciate it. And last but not least, so important, if you could leave us a review. That would be brilliant. A small, you know, hopefully a 5-star review with a word or two on iTunes or Spotify. And we would appreciate that in a big way. And then, you know, if you can, socially mediate the heck out of Face to Face and let people know what's going on here at Face to Face Live. We would appreciate it. But in the meantime, listen in to my wonderful interview and conversation with Mohammed Abugath and Daniel Carcente talking about their brilliant new film, The Devil's Drivers. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by two very special guests with us here today, kind of from around the world, I suppose, to talk about with their new film, The Devil's Drivers, at the Toronto International Film Festival. We have Daniel Carcente here with us and Mohammed Abugath. Thank you both for joining me today on Face to Face to talk about your fascinating and compelling new film.
You are welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you much for having us. It's an honor.
So I got to say right out of the gate before we start, this is, you know, I always try to choose films that I think my audience would enjoy seeing, that I think I would enjoy seeing. I loved your film. It's compelling. It's upsetting. It's unsettling. It's a celebration of the human condition, it seems to me. I mean, there's just so many challenging issues that you raise, but also some really beautiful and human moments that I think are going to stay with me for a long time. So I just wanted to say congratulations and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So why don't we kind of start at the beginning? I know this has been a really long project for you both, at least 8 years, I believe. And I'm pretty sure that I've read about some pretty significant challenges that you faced along the way. Either of you, Mohammed or Daniel, can you give us a little bit of context around the film and what you were trying to do with this out of the gate? Like, and then we can go a little deeper. Maybe Daniel, could you give us a bit of context out of the gate?
I think Mohammed's and my intention at the beginning was to find a character who was not the usual Middle Eastern or Palestinian stereotype. We wanted to have someone who is not fitting into this cliche of the Arab man as a terrorist.
Right.
Or as the poor victims, but we wanted to have a character who is three-dimensional. We wanted to develop a movie around someone who is taking his life into his own hands, who's making difficult choices. I think Mohammed and me think that actually, I hear many people say that Hamouda appears like a hero. I think for Mohammed and me, he's more actually an anti-hero, a person who we're also showing with his flaws, with his difficulties dealing with life, with his self-doubts. But on the other side, we also see him make hard decisions. We see him doing some very courageous things. So I think that was our main goal, to create a Travis Bickle or an interesting, flawed anti-hero as a part of what we would call, or what Mohammed would call, maybe something idea of a Palestinian new wave, a movie that is interested in showing the people not the way the world expects us to show them, but showing the people the way they really are.
Right. No, that's super helpful. Mohammed, would you say that you went into this story, this documentary, these lives, with the intent of kind of, you know, turning the narrative upside down, in a sense? As Daniel said, hero to anti-hero. Was that very much on your mind as you were making this film?
You know, we enjoyed making a film about, like, you can, in a simple way, Hollywood the characters, like, right, to make the character, like, right, in a Hollywood way.
That's a great, I love that phrase, to Hollywood the characters. That's a great phrase. Yeah.
To see the character eating, to see the character with his children, to see the character in his difficult work. So to see him in all his, around all his circumstances. So you just not to see his work or just to see his family. So we visited the world from different dimensions, and this is what we enjoyed doing it, making this film, just to show the character smiling, nervous, different circumstances. And we make it like three act long feature film in real life of people, which is other film. I think you needed Alberto De Niro and Brad Pitt, but we had like simple people who look like heroes or anti-hero in front of the camera. We focused more on the sound of the characters, on the, how they look, the reaction. So this is what make, I think, this film unique. It's not just because I am film. When I watched it in cinema, I was like, this is the first time I watched it in big screen. It was for me different. It shook me too. Like as film, as the one who did it, I became the audience. I just became the audience in the cinema.
That's fascinating. I don't know that I've ever heard a filmmaker say that quite that way. You know, that they saw the film for the, sort of for the first time. It was almost like it was a revelation for you, which is really interesting for that narrative experience.
Yeah, literally, I was shocked in some scenes when I saw it in big screen, because you see the eyes of the,
of course, yeah,
the characters. And because I was editing, I never had big screen or more than bigger than this computer to translate. So for me, when I saw it in a very huge screen, it made me feel different.
It's, you know what? That's really interesting. I the Toronto Film Festival this year for me has been a hybrid, and I've really not been there face to face. And most of my interviews have been online. And I saw a press conference though with Denis Villeneuve, Jessica Chastain, Benedict Cumberbatch, Alanis Abamsuin was there. I mean, a super star-studded panel. And Denis Villeneuve said the future of cinema is on the large screen. And it's really interesting to hear you say that you were so immersed in the small screen, to hear it from the translation had a huge impact. I think, you know, I want to stand up and applaud because that's amazing. I'm so glad, Mohammed, you talked about that. You know, when I first saw the film and I read the press kits and I do my research and I go in before I even see the film, I was about, I don't know, 7 minutes in, 5 to 7 minutes in. And I went, is this a documentary? Like there's a beat to it, a cadence to it that really does play like a thriller. And it is a thriller of a sort, but that almost sort of downplays the importance of it. Daniel, when you were shooting this, did you have that sense that you were going to, this was going to be a three act kind of film that Brad Pitt should have been starring in?
I mean, our circumstances during production were quite dramatic.
I bet they were.
So I think even the making of the film could be a thriller, actually.
A documentary about the documentary?
Yeah. But to your question, I think we were very early aware that this was a large story, that this was cinema. And we developed a technique that we always looked for the reaction and the emotions of our protagonist instead of looking for the physical action. So you'll see like many dangerous situations we're actually on the face, or we're trying to stay as long as we can on the face.
Sure, sure.
And I think one of the reasons why we're doing this is because we believe through, on the one side, news, the development of news reporting in the last years, but also, of course, throughout the 90s, Michael Bay cinema, that many dramatic things have already been shown. So if I would have to choose a drone image of the smugglers driving through the desert or a close-up of the face of the driver, I personally would say what interests me the most is his emotions. I want to give the audience the opportunity to feel what he's feeling. And by feeling what he's feeling, start to ask themselves, how would I react? How would I decide if I would have to make his choices?
Right, right.
And in that moment, the emotional becomes political, because in that moment, the moment I ask myself, like, would I risk my life to feed my family? Would I risk my life to have a moment of freedom? The moment when you start asking yourself this, you put together all the dots, all the circumstance, the political situation, the conflict, and you are forced to be him.
Right.
And I think that's what Mohammed and me as filmmakers really want to do. We don't have answers. We don't have solutions. But we have like a million questions. And this film is kind of like the result of our millions of questions.
So it's so good. I love what you said, Daniel, about all of that. The fact that you're sort of humble enough to say, we kind of still don't know. We've actually raised more questions. Mohammed, do you feel that, and this is a huge question, but I mean, the situation in the Middle East is complicated, to say the least. I mean, it's just such a massive understatement. And I think with stories like yours, and this is what's so important about the humanization of the conflict, or however you describe this, did you feel like you came away with any sort of new understanding of the complexity of it, the difficulty of it, you know, as you humanize Hamouda and is it Ismail and Ali, you know, our three characters in the film. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know, I really got many times a question from Hamouda, what can give me this film? He told me, I don't want money. I don't mean money. I mean, what can change in my life this film? Because he let us film with him. Ali, he knew that if he says something, we'll send it to the world. But Hamouda, he was not thinking in this way. He was telling me he wanted to change his life. But like from me and Daniel, we just put focus how their life difficult is. And like to put a spot on it and to make it big, that this problem is a problem of many society in the world.
Mm.
It could be in many countries. So I think to solve a problem, you need to solve the problem in whole world, in all countries. Like there is many different layers between poor, between like employee who is his employer. So many people are the injustice everywhere.
Sure.
And this is we put a spot how injustice, how difficult circumstances could be. We give them an example from Palestinian character who, and I learned a lot that, oh, okay, this is like what you can take in granted, what not.
Mm.
And for people who, like, I will repeat it many times, people who live in like privileged countries or rich countries, they don't see what they have. And I think this film gives you an impression to appreciate your life or to feel happy about what you have, even if it's not so big, you know. You don't have a big car, but you can drive in your car peacefully. You don't have a big house, but you can live in a house. Nobody will enter your house. So this gives also for anyone watch the film appreciation of his life or her life. Like, you know, their life is good outside.
An appreciation for something as simple as a job that allows you to provide for your family. I mean, isn't that a universal truth that we all can, you know, can empathize with? It's a beautiful thing. Was it Issa that said that you, or was it his son that said you lose control of your own destiny? in the middle of these types of situations where you've got to make these types of hard decisions. Daniel, did you ever come to a conclusion that you would make some of these same choices? That you would take your, you know, I mean, and how do you know unless you're sort of thrown into it, right? I mean, you can never really know until you're in the middle of something.
Sometimes I tell myself I would do the same thing too, but really honestly, you know, really looking at the price that these people are paying, I'm not 100% sure. I think the only thing that, I mean, Mohammed and me can say that we lived for years with them. We, for at least the first part of the film, we didn't have a hotel room, so we just slept at their places or at the places of friends who lived under similar circumstances. So maybe I did, in a way, decide to go the same way as they did. I can only say that, of course, the price for me personally was very high. Living a life like this is not very healthy, not very good for the nerves and the body itself. Sure. But then, of course, I only lived like 2% of what Hamoud or Ismail is going through. So I think at the end, I can never fully answer this question. I think there will always be a difference between us.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You know, one of the things I love about The Devil's Drivers and films like it and stories like it is I think it requires, and Mohammed, your comment about how you were struck by watching the film yourself as the filmmaker is going to stick with me for a long time, but I hope it helps us to empathize, you know, it situates us in that position to say, how would I behave? Which then would say, I'm going to start reflecting on some of these more difficult, ethical, philosophical, social and political questions, right? And you've embedded this so beautifully in this really human story. And again, it's just, it really is a remarkable thing. Mohammed, what about trust? you know, you got to know these men, these families, their wives, their children over, is it 8 years, 8 or 9 year period?
Yeah.
What about trust? Did they, I mean, were you filming in the car with them right away? Some of those shots are harrowing. I can't believe some of the images that you have from this film. So yeah, I'm fascinated by the relationship that you developed with Humoda and Ismail and Ali and so on.
Yeah, it took us 1 year and off.
1 year of just developing relationships?
Yeah, to go and back. And then we started to film with them, and we did like kind of hanging out with them, and we had like coffee with them. We had dinner with them. Once we invite them, once they invite us also. They are also like they we never built with we always been filmmaker and protagonist, but we also went down for them that we just stay there, and sometimes we don't feel we go home. We never gave them order. We never pushed them to film with us, and they let us film with them. And every time we were going there, it seems that it's the last day, but something happened, we continue. So also it's 9 years, but I didn't go there in 2012. I told them, hi guys, I will be here 9 years. So
yeah,
I never know by myself that I thought, okay, I will be here like 2 years, then I go. Three, I didn't know anything. So we were there also. We don't know like them. If they ask me, what do you want to shoot with us? What are you looking for? Sometimes I don't have the answer. I tell them, yeah, let's shoot with you. And then I watch what he's doing. Then, oh, okay, let's film in the car. Then, oh, he has a mechanic. Please let me film with the mechanic. Then we go to the mechanic to film with the mechanic. He let us. The next time he doesn't let us. We don't know why. Third time let us to film with him again. So it is like this. We live in some circumstances of filming that we react to the situation, and we were super polite with them. And you know, sometimes we have a conversation about a singer that they like, or about they love Mercedes and BMW. We talked about cars. So,
Did you ever talk about what Hollywood actor would play their part if this was like a big film? You brought up Robert De Niro and Brad Pitt, I believe. So I don't know. Maybe we can send out some emails.
We should.
We totally should. Listen, this is totally the kind of story, it seems to me, that would be turned, could potentially be turned into a narrative film for sure. You know, and this question's to both of you, and this is a big question. I think one of the opening lines of the film is, and I think we're seeing different images, and the narration is something to the effect of, and I think it's Ismail, I'm not sure, sentence me to prison without even looking at me. Is this a part of the bigger problem? I mean, my background's in philosophy, and as my listeners will know, in international development, and I've worked around the world, and I wonder, you know, we don't, us human beings don't listen very well. We don't build relationship always very well. And I so love that you embedded yourself with these families for a year before you even started shooting. You built that trust. I love how you open the film with that. Can we even talk about reconciliation until we can recognize and see the other? Does that make sense, Daniel?
Humoda often talks that the world is merciless.
Mm.
And I think the fact that the judge didn't even look at him when he sent him away from his newborn child is definitely a reflection on this. The question, I think, of reconciliation is, do I recognize your pain, my pain, and your pain? And I think that's the most difficult work. And only if I understand that you suffered in a way that's non-comparable and important, and my personal suffering is unconnected to yours in the terms of that what I feel is real and unique to me, but should never. I think what we need is to go from yes, but this is how we're living at the moment, to yes, and. The number one rule in improv theater, because you want to cooperate with the other actors on stage, is whatever they say, you answer yes, and. And I think if this idea of needing the other person instead of competing with the other person.
Right.
I think from that moment on, a process of healing is possible. I don't know if it's reconciliation. I mean, that's huge.
It's huge. Yep.
But I think alone recognizing the value and the legitimacy of the other person's pain and suffering could be an important step.
What a great phrase, the legitimacy of other people's pain. I mean, I wonder how willing we are even able to do that, emotionally and physically and spiritually, where all of us have our own families and our work and so on. And how could I ever be worried about the legitimacy of somebody else's pain on the other side of the world? And I would like to think, again, this is what's so beautiful about The Devil's Drivers and the empathy, I believe, that you have stirred up in your audience is essential to getting to a place where we can legitimize it. You know, the scenes with the soldiers, Muhammad, are disturbing and unsettling. It reminds me of, I don't know if you ever saw Brian De Palma's film Redacted, but he used a lot of actual footage connected in this narrative film from Iraq. And it was around, I'm going to say it was at TIFF about 5 to 7 years ago, and very disturbing shots of American soldiers going in and working, in Iraq and not really alongside Iraqi families, but intruding in this sense of kind of a different kind of violence, if you know what I mean. Did you see any kind of compassionate response where these soldiers said, well, hang on a minute here. These folks are just trying to live their lives. They're not terrorists. These are just men and women, mostly men, I guess, trying to provide for their families. Did you witness that at all? Did you see any of that kind of empathy or compassion? It's maybe a tough question.
No, we were never close to soldiers to know or to observe soldiers. We were always with the family. And when they came, the soldier, we were in a room. So I always hidden in the room and I didn't look at them and they didn't look at me. They just came and say, who are you? Go to the room. This is the only talk. They don't talk to us.
Right. They pushed you aside and focused on the families.
No, they put us all in one room.
Got it.
So then they, who are you? And they took the journalist ID.
Right. And
this is what the interaction with soldiers, just to take ID, to give ID and nothing else. I think they don't have soldiers hierarchy. And I think
of course
soldiers are not allowed to talk anything with the villagers. And for them, they are coming to a families, but they don't come to a family. They come for enemy, and they are put the enemy in a room. So there is no way of discussion, any kind of I don't know how to call it, but there is no way of sympathize or to explain it even in Arabic or any language. Soldier come to family. I don't think there is another way.
Muhammad, I think what you said about what I heard you say anyway was they're seen, these families are seen as the enemy. They're not seen as families. They're not seen as people that are just trying to provide. And I sort of understand that, But I wonder about that response. And if, you know, based on Daniel's notion of legitimacy of seeing somebody else, could a soldier ever do that? I don't know. That's a pretty big question, but it makes me reflect on how the police in the US and the police in Canada are now going through training. You know, when it comes to how they come onto a scene of a crime and they have to go through a different process and frankly, a more empathetic response, instead of just pulling out a handgun or pulling out a set of handcuffs, maybe there's a different response. Anyway, I am an idealist. I think we, I long and hope and trust for a better world, but it seems like we're a long way away. We got to wrap up soon. Did either of you ever feel like you were on your way to jail anytime soon? Did you ever feel like your lives were threatened? You must, the tension comes through in the film in such a palpable way. I can't imagine what it would have been like to be right alongside there. Daniel, can you talk to that at all? And then maybe Mohammed?
I think we felt more that we were on our way to the hospital. And sometimes right. To the graveyard more wow. than actually to jail. You need to be somewhere when you're shooting this film, you also need to be aware of the dangers, but you also not want to do it, but you need to have a physical or mental state of mind that can deal with it. And I remember that night, for example, when we were in the village, when the soldiers came in at 5 a.m, I think we both fell asleep like at 11 and I woke up at 4:45 and I looked at the watch and I was like, wow, no one is coming. We knew that they would come in the morning. The villagers had told us. And I looked at the watch, 4:45, they're not coming. And the next thing is that they break through the door. That means I must have fallen asleep again.
Right.
So in a way, I guess we were in a mental state of having adapted to this danger, and our body and our mind had accepted our role in there. And I think in those moments, we're very aware of the temporariness of our human existence. Mm. And we know that there are higher powers that could just interrupt everything in this moment. But I think telling a story like this is the job of a filmmaker. And I think Mohammed and me, we just recognized our call and took it. And will we do it again? I don't know. Because Mohammed and me, we're not war reporters. I think that's very important. Right. We're not going to front lines. We're not embedded with troops. We actually were doing the opposite. We're living with civilians for a long time. And sometimes the war comes and sometimes the war passes over and right. leaves again. And we're both also not, we're not going to front lines to search deaths. We're going to villages to find deep stories that we tell over a long period of time.
Yeah, I think it's remarkable how the fact that you aren't those type of journalists and yet you were embedded for this long as you sought to tell the story. I also think it's interesting, Daniel, that you said you're not sure that you would do this again. I mean, it must have been incredibly, incredibly taxing and challenging on so many levels from a production perspective as well, and the funding of it and all of that. Mohammed, we're going to wrap up here in a minute and would you do this again? I mean, and maybe that leads to the next question. Do you already have another project in mind?
Honestly, I'm working on a feature, fiction, narratives. My next project is narratives. So I'm working this. I'm shooting short movies and I'm working in narratives. So, again, when we started to do this film, we didn't know the result. So what came out something like you can say we didn't plan it, but we wanted to do something big, and we wanted to do a long feature film, and this is what it came. This is what happens. Like, if you have sense of characters, because when you see Hamouda shouting and we saw her without filming with him, we had the feeling that, oh my God, this is a film character. And right. We followed him, and this is what came. And we found around him another characters. Then for me, sometimes I think I was filming with characters without asking them what to do. They took the job for me to guide the actors. They were my actors, and they were working my job as a director just to do what inside me I wanted. And then they gave me more than I thought, honestly, sometimes. Maybe also Daniel, we never thought that this could happen in a film like this.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing film. And I love that you, as so many documentarians, go into a story, they don't necessarily know where it's going to wind up. And I so love where you wound up with this film. And Daniel, your comment about it raises more questions than provides answers, I think is probably really accurate and true, but I do hope and trust that it will take people places where they can empathize and start thinking about what some of those answers might be. And if I could just end with, you know, Daniel, you talked about focusing on faces and the reactions. How did you come to that decision? Because I think it's so important. I always see a bit of a theme in the films that I watch at any festival, because you kind of get immersed, you know, in 10 or 12 or 15 films. Can you talk just briefly as we wind up the focus on the face? I just think talk about legitimizing somebody else. Focusing on their face is just a beautiful way to go.
We noticed very early in the production that even though we're shooting a film in the desert, which could be like a Western or a freedom theme, actually the most of our film was taking place in very, very small spaces in extreme confinement. So in a way, what we shot is a chamber play, as absurd as it might sound. And for me, a chamber play will always become a psychological drama. For me, it's always about what is going on in the mind and what triggers the next decision. What are these people feeling? What are the inner workings that motivate someone to go actually through this incredibly dangerous situation over many, many, many years? And I think that's also the puzzle that Mohammed and me are putting together with this film, or assisting the audience to put together.
Sure, it's so good. Yeah.
With this film, like, the value of freedom, the pursuit of freedom, the risks that you take to gain freedom, and the price that you pay when you lose it. I think those were the themes that we try to discover in the minds and the feelings of our protagonists.
It's so good. What a beautiful way to end this interview. The value of freedom and the risks we take and the price we pay. What a pleasure chatting with you both and meeting you both. We've been talking to Daniel Carcente and Mohammed Abougeth about their brilliant new film, The Devil's Drivers, at the Toronto International Film Festival, and hopefully coming soon to a digital theater near you. Thank you to you both.
Thank you very much for having
us. Thank you. Thank you, David, for having us, for hosting us so gently.
Been a pleasure. So there you have it, my conversation with Mohammed Abougeth and Daniel Carcente, talking about their brilliant Toronto International Film Festival film, The Devil's Drivers. That's a bit of a mouthful there, Toronto International Film Festival film. Hey, thanks for joining us and for listening in. I hope you get to see this film. It is brilliant. It really is quite something. And I don't think you've seen a film like this before. So if you get the chance, look for it in the not so distant future. Video on demand or coming soon to a theater or maybe a festival near you. And don't forget davidpecklive.com, facetofacelive.ca. Please sign up for our newsletter. Only a few of those go out a year. Please leave us a review where you listen to podcasts. And more importantly, sign up for the podcast. Subscribe to that feed. We would appreciate it. And continue to listen and share us, what we're doing here with family and friends on social media at Face to Face. I would certainly appreciate it a great deal. And I know my guests would too. We are going to continue to have these conversations, I think, for many years to come. And I look forward to continuing the conversation with so many thoughtful, talented, brilliant filmmakers and writer, producer, actors. So stay tuned for more coming up in the not so distant future. But in the meantime, thanks again for listening to us here on Face to Face.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.